You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everybody. It's a lovely spring day, and we appreciate your taking some time off to come indoors for what I think will be not just an enlightening and timely conversation, but occasionally here at the Brookings Institution, even when talking about pretty serious issues, we're allowed to have fun. And a conversation with Javier Solana is always enlightening and almost always fun. The closer we get to Iran, the less fun it becomes. But I don't think Iran quite falls into the geographic ambit of our conversation today. But before I give Javier a chance to make a couple of opening remarks, I wanted to say to Ambassador Dethgayar how much we appreciate your being here this morning, how much we appreciate your being a leading and very active and distinguished member of the diplomatic corps, and we wish you all kinds of luck on your next assignment. This event is brought to you under the auspices of our Center on the United States in Europe, which is headed up by my friend and colleague Fiona Hill, who's grading my performance here in the front row. I'm used to that. And next to her is Rich Kauselrich, who was the first person to really help me impersonate a diplomat back in 1993. So it's great of you to turn up here too, Rich. Javier and I are friends, but that doesn't in any way disqualify me or require me to make a statement of recusal about saying a few things about his career. You all, as I look around this audience, I see lots of folks who know not only the issues but the leadership personalities that are associated with these issues, and Javier doesn't require a traditional introduction. But I'll just say in a personal vein, having gotten to know him when he was the foreign minister of Spain and then had a kind of crash course in his many virtues during the episode which resulted in his being the Secretary General of NATO, and then working with him very, very closely in that capacity, including on two of the most challenging issues that the alliance has ever faced. And it's kind of significant in a way that both occurred after the end of the Soviet Union, which, of course, and the Warsaw Pact, the combination of which, of course, was the raison d'etre of NATO. But some very tough challenges arose in the wake of that. One was the expansion of NATO, which has some relevance to our topic of conversation today. And the other was the first time that NATO went to war in the Balkans. And Javier and I had a chance to work together both on the waging of that war, which lasted for 78 days and 13 hours and 20 minutes, not that anybody was counting. And we also worked very closely on bringing it to an end. And he was nothing less than heroic, both in the exercise of hard power and also as a diplomat. And, of course, as you all know, he was the closest thing that Europe has ever had to a foreign minister, and was immensely accomplished and distinguished in that role as well. And speaking of distinguished, he is a distinguished fellow of the Brookings Institution, which brings great pride and satisfaction to all of us. Javier, what I thought we might do before we get into the topic that Fiona has assigned us, which is talking about the neighborhood and the borders and the periphery of Europe, is for you just to share with our friends here a little bit both on your experience of Europe, how you see Europe to have evolved, what Europe is, to what extent is it geographical, to what extent is it cultural, to what extent is it idea-based, and to what extent is Europe as a concept stressed or even imperiled by what's going on there now. And then with that in mind, we can go on to talk about the regional challenges.
Well, thank you very much, Straub, for your kind words. I can speak as a friend and tell that among the list of my most dear friends, probably you are at the top. We have lived so many things together, and we continue to live, which is really for me has been a pleasure, continues to be a pleasure, and I'm very happy to be at Brookings. Now, I was tempted to start answering this question, which I didn't know was going to be placed in the first one, by imagining that we don't have an economic crisis. Let's suppose that we don't have a crisis. And let's take a look at the European Union in a situation you want before 2008 or 2009, or if you prefer to forget the crisis for a moment, and I think it will be a good exercise for everybody of optimism. Now, Europe is a group of countries that had a very dramatic history, a group of countries that were able to go up into the most sublime situations in history, produced in poets, music, cathedrals, but going down very low in the most dramatic events and suffering that a man can impose on another man, or a country can impose on another country. We have had wars of 30 years for religious matters, wars of 100 years for religious plus matters. And if we get closer to the last century, two wars which were terrible. They start in Europe, and they became global. So we cannot be very proud of that part of our history. We can be proud of part of our history when we create beauty and good values, etc. But we have done really terrible things. So when I look at Europe, I have that sentiment of trying to balance these two issues. And I think the end of the Second Great War was a good moment to say, basta. Let's try to avoid that we produce war. Let's try not to fight among ourselves. And let's try to construct something that could be a model for other places of the world to be used. And what did we do? We try to put in common or to pull together something very delicate, which is sovereignty. And we began to, in a pragmatic manner, try to pull together sovereignty in these issues and move on and try to get the pull in the sovereignty on every time more difficult issues. That, as you know, is a very difficult process. And that's why it takes a long time. But if I were to look back to the beginning of the European Union, 1950, with six members, and you look today at the European Union today with 27 members, with a monetary union, with borders in common, you can imagine the effort and the imagination and the courage that has to be on the leaders to go that far in transferring or putting together or pulling together sovereignty. Now, everything went fairly well because we finished in 2005 with the stabilization of the continent. All the member states that were part of new member states, but have been Europeans, Poland has been a European country, Czech Republic has been a very important country, etc. And they are all members of the European Union and the institutions around the European Union. And all that has been done freely. You have given up or pulled together sovereignty without shooting a shot. We have incorporated countries that have been in the Warsaw Pact without any willingly and without shooting. I think that is an example of construction of constitutional architecture for the world, which has been done in a manner which, to my mind, is miraculous. Problems, slow, difficult to decision-making process, etc. But at the end, it's such a beautiful building that I'm still impressed. Now, 2009, we finished a very important treaty that started when we thought about creating a new constitution for Europe, you remember. The treaty, due to several difficulties in the journey to come to the end, the Constitution ended up in a treaty, 2009, that changed completely or deepened very much the integration of the European Union. For instance, practically no decision will be taken by unanimity. Just about every decision will be taken by qualified majorities, which is a fantastic, fantastic step in the right direction for creating a structure which can be more functional. But at that time, when we were beginning to do that, came our friend the crisis, or our enemy the crisis. And he caught us at a very complicated moment. We had not finished. We just finished one of the treaties, but we had not started to change and to adapt what is the most important thing that is needed when you are in a crisis, which is the governance of the economy and the financial part of the European Union. So here we are. And I'm not going to enter into the crisis. We spent the whole day just talking about that. But I want to tell you that I would like to see the way ahead of this European Union continued with the same mechanism, with the same manners, not mechanism, the same manner, the same values, the same principle, the same morale, the same potentiality that we have constructed in the past. And I imagine the European Union in 5 years, 7 years, whatever years, in a more integrated union, pulling together more sovereignty, and trying to be a good institution for the citizens, a good institution for the region, and a good institution for the world. Because allow me to say that from my travels, and I travel a lot in the last many, many years, I have a sense that you probably don't sense it, but I have the sense that this demand of Europe is the demand in the world of the voice of Europe. What does it mean? Europe has a manner of doing things, some right, some wrong, but it's a demand that the European Union, the structure that we have created, had a voice in the world of today. In the world of today that we need, as you know very well, is structures of governance for the global world. We have common global problems. We need global institutions to solve the global, to find the global solution. And I think that molecule in the world, which is the European Union, which those values, with this way of doing things, I think will be very much appreciated in the world of today. And that's what I'm going to continue devoting my energy, whatever is my capacity is left. But I would like very much to finalize that beautiful journey, which is the European Union. We are not going to fool ourselves. We are in a very difficult situation. Very difficult situation. And for the first time, I would like to say, well, I don't like to say, but I have to say, that we may fail. We may fail. But I hope very much that we will overcome. And what we will have at the end of the day is a Europe which is more integrated and continue to have relations with all the countries that belong to the European Union, their neighborhood, good relations with the United States, and a voice in the international arena.
That was excellent. And it leads right into the assigned topic. And if you would give us a few thoughts on the neighborhood and with as much particular reference as you feel is appropriate to some specific countries, recognizing, of course, as we all do, that there are very significant differences among these countries and very significant differences among the challenges that they pose to the question of expanding either the actual membership of the European Union or even partnership with the European Union. And I'm thinking here particularly, of course, about the largest of those countries and one of the more problematic, which is the Russian Federation. Turkey, which is indisputably a European country and very much part of European history and I would say European culture. By the way, Javier has been here several times since then, but just about exactly a year ago, he presented the Sabancı Lecture here on this stage, addressing the question of Turkey and its role in the world, and particularly its role vis-a-vis the United States and Europe. You might have a word or two to say about Georgia, and take it in any, and Ukraine for sure. Bill Miller is here, a former ambassador to Ukraine. And then after Javier offers his thoughts on that menu of subtopics, we'll throw it open to all of you and bring you into the conversation.
Okay. Let me start with Turkey. Turkey, I do that because it's a different country from the others. Turkey is a candidate to be a member of the European Union, and I would like to underline that. That is the reality of today. It is true that those negotiations are not moving very fast. When I was talk last year on the Salanchi lecture that Stoptal has mentioned, I said that I expected one chapter to be open in the negotiation and close in that year. Now, we are today as we were a year ago. Nothing has happened really on the way of advancing the negotiation. What have we done? What have we done? I'm not in the leadership of the European Union anymore. When I talk we, it's them. I am not part of it, but I feel so close that I still talk about we. What we have done is to create accelerated track, if I may say, on political matters with Turkey. And this is for the advantage of Turkey, but in particular for the advantage of the European Union. Because to tell you the truth, if we were to talk about foreign policy of the European Union together, without Turkey, because it's only a candidate, not a member, if you were to look at Turkey, probably today, in the part of the neighborhood in which we have in mind, Turkey is more important than the whole of the European Union. And this is difficult to recognize, but it's a reality. Vis-à-vis Syria, vis-à-vis the situation in the Arab Spring, etc., the role of Turkey is very, very important. So we have created a channel of communication with Turkey on political matters fast. But it's true that we are still not come to a solution to what is going to be the end game of the relationship between the European Union and Turkey. I hope, and I defend with passion, that should be a member of the European Union. It will be very important for the European Union to have that country, a big country, a country which is Muslim, a country which is democratic, and a country that will bring vitality to the European Union that we need. But I think that is my position. But as you know very well, it's not the position of everybody. Now, let me go into the problems that I see. And I see problems which we have to overcome with a lot of intelligence in the coming year. In the second semester of this year, Cyprus will be in charge of the representation of as the rotatory president of the European Union, Cyprus. As you know, Cyprus is a big problem in our relations with Turkey, and one of the reasons why Turkey has it more difficult than other countries is because of Cyprus. Turkey is not going to recognize Cyprus as the presidency of the European Union. They have been said already, and the preparatory work is clearly that they are not going to deal with Cyprus. I mean, let me complicate a little bit more the issue. As you know very well, in the not long period of time, oil and gas has been discovered in the Mediterranean, very close to the coast of Cyprus, close to the coast of Israel, and very close to the coast of Lebanon. All of this is new. This is a new parameter that enters into the picture. Because if you are going to drill in the waters that Cyprus will say is my waters, and Turkey will say it's not the waters of Cyprus because Cyprus doesn't exist for them. Cyprus still doesn't exist for them. We are going to have a little bit of a problem. Let me tell you that to complicate more the issue, Cyprus has been a country with great influence from Russia. You know that. I don't want to enter into that, but you know very well that a lot of laundering of money has been done in Cyprus from Russia. But also was a place where the Palestinians had a very good friendship. They have been in Cyprus, they found as a second or third house. Now, if I were to tell you that in the last 2 months, the president of Israel has been in Nicosia twice, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has been four times, you see how things are really changing in Cyprus. And that is due to a fact which is new in the scheme of the many problems of the Mediterranean, which in principle is positive, discovery of gas, discovery of oil, how to handle it, etc. But it may be also a cause of preoccupations, concerns, and even very, very complicated tension. So let me start with to put Turkey in that perspective, a very important country for us, a very important country for the region, and a country that has a role to play vis-à-vis Cyprus, and therefore vis-à-vis the European Union, negative direction. Okay. Now, that's as far as Cyprus is concerned. Let me go to Russia. I'm going to go very... Russia is the first country that in 2012 had elections. There are going to be others. It's going to be France. There are going to be the United States. It's going to be a fundamental change in China. So 2012, from the electoral point of view, has been fascinating. No member of the Security Council will have the same leadership, probably. UK, yes, because they voted already last year. But, I mean, there's a big change in the P5. Nobody's going to have the same leadership. Well, the same leadership, potentially. Now, the president of Russia, we know him. Has been president already and has been prime minister twice. So it's somebody we know fairly well. The point which is new, I think, is that being the same person, the country is not the same. Russia is different. And I think he has tested on the streets of Moscow what does it mean, the limit of power. I don't think, first one, he won with the number of votes we got, he expected more. And then with the demonstrations and the position of the civil society, I think that Putin has got a picture clearly on his skin of what is limitation of power. And I think that this is an important fact that we have to use it properly. With Russia, we have a very good relationship, formally, which is called the Partnership for Modernization. That was done with Medvedev, thinking that the most important problem for Russia is modernizing. And whatever we can do in that direction, we will try to help. Modernization and rule of law, to my mind, which are linked, are the two most important things to change from the European Union point of view in Russia. Let me go to a good event that has taken place in the year 2011 that has not been so much realized. Maybe the end game, yes, but not the process. As you know, Russia finally, in 2011, entered in the WTO. That is a fundamental change also in the picture. Remember, when China entered the WTO was the beginning of having a new country, emerging country, playing by the rules. Not only playing with the rules, but playing by the rules, or trying to play by the rules, but they have rules, WTO. Now we have Russia with WTO. And you remember why Russia was not in the WTO. If you don't remember, I'm going to tell you. It was not in the WTO because Georgia vetoed the entrance of Russia in the WTO. I don't have to explain why Georgia vetoed. Things happened not long ago that put the relationship between Russia and Georgia in a very bad situation. Now, how have we solved that problem? How, at the end, Georgia has changed the vetoes vis-à-vis the entrance of Russia into WTO, has been a very beautiful political and diplomatic move. It has been done with a trick of how you recognize the borders of South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and with two elements. One, it was negotiated by Geneva, by a country that always uses his good offices to solve complicated problems. And with the presence still on the ground of the missions of the police mission by the European Union there, that control in a way the borders. So a very complicated setup has been established that without recognizing anybody, Georgia of course recognized that Abkhazia and Abkhazia are part of Georgia. Russia recognized that they are part of, they are independent countries. And at the same time we have organized a mechanism that allows for these two countries to control the borders in such a manner that both can be part of the WTO. This is a good thing that has happened in this year. Let me go a little bit more to Georgia. With Georgia, we have a very close relationship, an association agreement that has not finalized, which is a very important thing. When you have with the country an association agreement for the European Union, it's very important. We have worked with them in order to generate what I think they should generate is a better climate with the people in South Abkhazia and Ossetia,
and we have done that with them, Georgia. But we're a little bit concerned about Georgia on the Democratic side. And I understand that the United States begin to be some concern about that. Debate took place the other day in the Congress for the first time. Now, in the coming year, 2012, in the year 2013, it will be elections, parliamentary and presidential. We are going to look very carefully at the parliamentary elections to see how it's done. As you know, some other leaders are emerging from the Georgia society, in particular one very rich man that I don't want to enter into that, which is probably trying to consolidate the opposition in one party and may at the end maybe even challenging Saakashvili in 2013. Okay, with that I close the first thing that I wanted to say about Georgia, and I would like to enter into Ukraine. Ukraine for me is one of the great frustrations that I had in my life. I was very engaged with Ukraine from the very beginning. I was in the negotiation with Alexander Wanniewski, the ex-president of Poland, when the Orange Revolution started and when the elections that took place at that year, 2002, I think it was, and Yanukovych won the elections and it was denounced. And at the end, remember that the elections were redone, and Viktor Yushchenko won the elections, was president for a long period of time. All that period of time that started beautifully, with oranges and all these things, lasted very little. The battle between Yulia Tymoshenko and Viktor Yushchenko was so tough and so difficult that we have Viktor Yushchenko in his house, lost all the political power, and Yulia Tymoshenko in jail. And Yanukovych, who was the loser of the first election, is now the president of the country. So for me it's a great frustration, because it's a country that could have done way much better than what he have done. And it has all the complications of a political class, which is really below average, and the incompatibility of characters together with, in a way, two Ukrainians, one in the east and one in the west, one who looks more to Russia and one who looks more to Europe. And they have the problem of being a transit country for energy, which is always is a problem if you don't have your neighbors in good relationship. So for the European Union, it continues to be a big problem. And we are not going to, we signed on the 28th of March of this year, a few days ago, the finalization of the associate initial, not finalized, initial, an agreement that I started in 2005 with Viktor Yushchenko. So slowly going from 2005 to initial, is not implemented because with the situation of the justice, which the question of Yulia Tymoshenko in jail, and others, because it's not the only person which is in jail, the other political figure, important political figure, we work with Viktor Yushchenko, which is also in jail. So, if you look at the whole picture, I'd like to say something good. The European Union, even in this complicated situation economically, continues to be active politically with our neighborhood. Good things, some. And other things which are not moving as I would have liked to see moving. But keep in mind that one of the things we are going to see in this neighborhood is going to be important related to the position of Turkey vis-à-vis the gas, vis-à-vis Cyprus, and vis-à-vis other issues like Syria, etc., which are very, very important for the European Union. So this is how I see the picture, with realistic optimism. I don't know if we want to put the capital in the realistic or the optimistic, but in a balanced relative optimism, I think I see the situation. In any case, if we were to look 10 years back, the situation is way much better. I will be today much more concerned than with my neighborhood, with some members of the European Union. Let me mention one. I'm much more concerned with Hungary than I am concerned with other countries which are outside the European Union from the democratic point of view.
Great. Okay, there's a lot of hands are going up. I'll alternate around. I'll take this gentleman here whose hand went up first, I think, and then we'll come to one of the two ladies over here. Oh, just one sec. And please, thank you.
I'm correspondent of Danube News Agency from Serbia, and my question is on Serbia and Kosovo. 4 years ago, United States and 20 EU countries recognized self-declared independence of Kosovo. From then, we've seen murders of Serbs there, accusations of human organ trafficking, and highest level of corruption in Kosovo. Besides that, some regions in the world, like South Ossetia or Tuaregs in Mali, are asking today for independence, and they are comparing their position and their situation with Kosovo's situation. Your country, Spain, didn't recognize Kosovo. Do you think that after these 4 years, recognition of Kosovo was a mistake, and do you think that Spain will change her position? Thank you.
Well, I cannot talk on behalf of Spain. I may have a little bit of influence, but no power whatsoever. So, you can imagine, I was in favor of the recognition of Kosovo. We did a tremendous amount of effort to get it in a different manner. Remember that Ambassador Ischinger from Germany was in charge of a troika with the Russians and with the United States in order to prepare that. Finally, it was impossible. It was impossible to do it, and it was recognized. Kosovo was recognized by countries. The European Union doesn't recognize countries. It's the member state of the European Union that recognizes countries. And a good number of countries did recognize it. A smaller number of countries didn't recognize. And still the situation continues to be like that. No change, to my mind, has taken place since the moment. Now, what is taking place, something positive, I think, is A, on Serbia, and Serbia is now much closer to the European Union. It has been elected to be a candidate for membership of the European Union. It will have elections in the coming period of time. I don't know what will be the result of the elections in Serbia, but with Boris Tadic as president, we have worked very well, and we have moved. And as you know, for that step to be taken to get Serbia as a candidate, it was necessary to get a better relationship with Kosovo. And a big effort has been done by both sides to try to solve the question of, in particular, the zone of Mitrovica and all these things. I am not going to say that everything is resolved, because I would be lying to you. But without any doubt, things are better than they used to be. And with the help of the European Union producing this, or giving that confidence to Serbia that they will be member of the European Union, I think that something will come out in the right direction, solid. I will not compare with South Ossetia and Abkhazia. South Ossetia and Abkhazia, remember, that have been recognized by very important countries of the world, and very close, very neighbors of the region of South Asia. So the two countries were recognized in Latin America. One is Venezuela and the other is Nicaragua. None, not even Minsk, has recognized South Asia and Ossetia. So it's a little bit different, don't you think, than Kosovo?
If you could bring the mic up here, I'll let these two ladies each ask a question, and then, Javier, you can perhaps respond to both of their questions.
Thank you. Maya Kay from Voice of America Georgian Service. I have a question about Georgia. What do you think, what could Georgia expect from upcoming Chicago summit of NATO, if anything? And if I may, the second question, in case of war with Iran, how would it play out for Georgia? What are the prospects?
Well, maybe just lodge the second question as well.
Sorry. Thank you. Clara O'Donnell, non-resident fellow with the Centre on US and Europe here at Brookings. I had a question on Russia and arms sale. There have been in recent years several cases where European countries have chosen to sell arms to Russia, including the Mistral case, which was quite controversial within NATO. And I was wondering, what are your views on the merits of these sales? And is there anything that NATO or the EU can do to avoid such sales creating tensions amongst other NATO allies?
Sales. Do you need clarification on that?
I don't know if I grasp what are the sales that you're talking about.
Well, the fact that the fact that France chose to sell the Mistral ships to Russia created quite a lot of tension amongst some of the Central European countries. And I was wondering, is it a good idea that countries do these sales, and what do we do to reassure others?
Okay.
Thanks.
Now, on the first question on Georgia, I cannot speak on behalf of NATO, but I know something. I don't think they are going to get much from the situation that was in the previous summits. This is my feeling, but I may be wrong. You have an agreement, and which at that level that it is today, I do not expect to move very much. That is my impression. But again, I cannot. Preparatory work is being done still, and I don't know what will be the end. Now, from Iran. Iran complicates many issues in the international arena, but I don't know how it's going to affect Georgia. I don't know if you have an angle of looking that in which Iran and Georgia have any relationship.
There has been some speculations, specifically Brzezinski just told journalists a couple days ago that in case of war, Russia will become more aggressive and will try to reestablish the old military bases there.
That is a statement by I don't know whom.
Brzezinski.
Brzezinski again. I mean, really, with great respect to him. But, I mean, it's a statement which I think is going too far. Still, there's no war with Iran. It's very, very, very. We expect that Russia will continue to be together in the group of the P5 plus the European Union, and in the approach that we have collectively vis-à-vis Iran. The five countries, the P5 plus European Union, have done, they don't want to have a nuclear Iran. And that is the. So I don't see. You have to imagine first that the group of five breaks, then there is a war, then the Russians say, well, it's looking too far, I think, from today. I hope that we will not have to look into that for a long period of time.
And France and arms sales?
I think that we don't have any limitation of selling of anything with Russia. We have still some limitation with China, but not with Russia. And I think the problem we have with Russia, and I hope the only problem really that we have to solve with Russia, is the missile defense. And I hope very much that in Chicago we take a step in that direction, of doing something that overcomes the mistrust that still exists, in particular in the phase fourth of the deployment of the missile defense. Up to the phase fourth, we can live with mistrust, but if you deploy the phase four, it will be quite a difficult situation. So I think this is can be overcome. Now, look at the coming period of time. In the coming period of time, we have in the neighborhood of the European Union, I can talk because it's the neighborhood of the European Union, we have a complicated situation in Syria, in which we are in different. Russia has a position which is different from ours. Okay? Ours, I mean Europeans and Americans. We have the missile defense in which NATO countries and Russia have a different position. And we have a negotiation with Iran, which is the priority, in which we need to have a common position with the Russians. So we have a triangle there of Russia vis-à-vis Syria, Russia vis-à-vis missile defense, and Russia vis-à-vis Iran that we have to solve. And we have to bet. What do we prefer? If you ask me what I would prefer to solve Iran together with Russia. And therefore, I will have to give something in other theaters. I think that the easy one for me will be get an agreement on missile defense. I think it's possible. I don't think that it will be compatible to have an agreement in Iran and not to have it in Syria at the end of the day, because Syria and Iran are pretty linked in a way also. Therefore, I will try to maintain as much as possible the good relationship with Syria on these two topics and be as generous as possible in missile defense, which will take place in Chicago in a few weeks. Now, if you remember, there was a picture in the New York Times not long ago and a microphone open. You remember? It was a conversation between President Obama and President Medvedev. We didn't listen completely the phrase of them for the microphone, but we noises were. And my sentiment is that President Obama thinks also that missile defense can be resolved.
But I would just add a footnote to that. It ain't going to happen in Chicago in terms of a consummated agreement. We have to work out our own democratic leadership process first. So we're talking about
Chicago is the moment it will be meetings.
That could lay the ground for something in 2013.
Okay, you are more precise.
No, I just... there we are. It's awfully hard to conduct foreign policy in a presidential election year. This lady right here.
My name is Ravza Kavakce. I'm a PhD candidate at Howard University. It's always a pleasure to listen to you. Thanks to Brookings Institute for giving us this opportunity. I wanted to ask a question regarding the future of Europe. We know that, as you mentioned, it's an one-of-a-kind institution, one-of-a-kind organization where nations are pooling in their sovereignty. Let us imagine that we get over the crisis with Greece and everything goes well. How far do you think it'll go? I mean, from the Turkish perspective, there's always concern about how many more wagons can this train take, how much load can it take? So where do you see EU once we're over this crisis? Will there be a real political union? Mm-hmm. Will it be United States of Europe? That's what my question is. Thank you.
Let me tell you what it will not be, so we clarify. It will not be in a state. It will be not a United States of Europe. I don't think we'll go that far. So from there, we can come back. I think there will be much more than what it is today from the point of view of integration. And the difficulty you will understand very well, because the things that we have to integrate today are really at the nucleus of the sovereignty. Is how do who fixes taxes, fundamental for a nation state, and who approves the budget, which is another important thing. Remember that we have abandoned the control of our borders. The borders are common now, which is a very important thing. And for some countries, 17 countries, the monetary union, the currency is the same. So therefore, we have to open a process of integration that has already been marked. It will be in a step in the right direction in changing the treaty by the end of 2013. And we will be moving in that sense. Now, the problem is that not every of the 27 members will be ready to be moving at that rhythm. And so it comes another problem. Is it a Europe with two speeds, or is it a Europe of two tiers? I mean, when you talk to an Anglo-Saxon, the UK member of the parliament, they will say, well, we would like a European Union with two tiers. That means that countries that not necessarily go in the same direction. I do not conceive that. I conceive or I can think about a European Union with two speeds. That means with a direction and two rhythms, or different rhythms. And the point which makes difficult the structure is how the common institutions do apply to the different countries which are at a different rhythm. And, of course, when we enter into such a level of integration, the legitimacy is very, very important. So the relation between the citizens and their bodies and their institutions is very important. If you lose that relation with your own state, in issues as important as budget, you really have to be sure that you give it to somebody you trust that has the legitimacy to do it. And for some countries, the situation that we have today is becoming a little bit difficult because they may extrapolate and think that a couple of countries, or a country and a half, or three countries and a half, may have more power. And I would not like to have an institution which is the European Union ruled by power. I would like to be ruled by law. And this is one of the most important things in the basis of the European Union, by law. And sometimes we have the impression, or people may have the impression, that country X or country Y may impose something on others. And that is something I will reject. And I think most of the people will reject. And I think that perceptions that have to change. The realities have to change, and the perceptions have to change.
Yes, sir, right there. White shirt in the middle there.
I'm Brian Beery, Washington correspondent for Europolitics. My question is about EU enlargement. And you touched on Ukraine and Georgia, and I would add Belarus. I mean, when you were foreign policy chief, the EU had a clear policy not to explicitly open the door for membership for those countries. And then you're just pointing out that their democracy record is bad or going backwards. Do you think that it was a mistake? Not when you look at the Balkans, although you have problems in the Balkans, they are sort of edging gradually towards better democracy because they have the EU membership carrot, whereas the Ukraine, Belarus, and Georgia don't have that. And do you think that in hindsight or in future that the EU should change its policy?
Well, I don't see, from the circumstances of today, with the crisis, etc., I don't see any change in that direction. Maybe we have enough complicated problems to complicate more. But I will try to answer your question by saying that it is true that the magnetic pole, the attraction of Brussels, has made transformations in countries very rapidly and peacefully. The case of Poland, Hungary, etc., which Hungary now is less attractive, but the attraction of the magnetic pole has changed many things. This is really soft power at its best. How countries have changed their structures, their democratic values or democratic institutions, etc., without use of anything but it's of very soft power, which is the attraction to be part of the European Union.
Javier, go ahead.
I think that that magnetic pole, it has less attraction today than it used to have. And therefore, the capacity to transform by soft power, magnetic pole attraction, those countries you are mentioning, it was much more difficult today. I think that it will have to give the European Union much more to compensate for the loss of, at this moment, the loss of credibility of the European Union, even for them. So this is a difficult situation, but I don't think, difficult moment. But I think that Serbia will be part of the European Union. I am not sure that Ukraine will be part of the European Union, and I will not be sure that Georgia will be part of the European Union ever. I'm not sure about that, but I'm pretty sure that Serbia will be.
Javier, I wonder if you could just say a word in your capacity. You're a citizen of the world and a European, but you're also a Spaniard. Say something about the magnetic effect of Europe's consolidation as a community of democracies in the evolution of your own country.
Well, I was of the generation of people in my country that went through the change from a dictatorship to a democracy. And therefore, for us, for me, for my generation, the European Union, where we should have been, and we were not, because we were not a democracy, it was a dream. For me, always, Europe has been, we have a phrase, allow me to repeat it, Spain is the problem, Europe is the solution, we used to say. We continue to think, I continue to think very deeply, that Europe is the solution. Europe is the solution. And I think for many countries, when you talk seriously with people, they will agree with this. Europe is the solution. But for my own country, it has been a fundamental, absolutely fundamental. The moment we had the perspective of being part of the European Union, after we had the constitution, the first democratic elections, etc., etc., we have been absolutely one of the most pro-European countries. And much of the things that Spain has done, which has done many in this period of time, were always linked to the pertinence to the membership of the European Union.
Yes, the gentleman there, right behind you, yes.
Thank you very much, Garth Trinkle, Department of Commerce. I have another Eastern neighborhood question concerning Ukraine, Moldova, Belarus. Your statement on Turkey was clear. You talked earlier about Cyprus and the discovery of natural gas and oil. There's also exploration for fracking, for extraction going on in Poland, in West Ukraine, in East Ukraine. 2014 is going to be, in small part, the year of Sochi, Russian Federation. Putin is now in preparation for his reascension in May, talking about the Eurasian Union, and the Polish foreign minister very much wants Ukraine in the European Union. Putin very much wants Belarus, Kazakhstan, Ukraine not in the European Union. Do you see tensions going forward because of the gas resources on the continental shelf of the Black Sea?
Well, you've brought a very fascinating topic.
Sorry if it was too long.
No. Very fascinating topic because shale gas is going to be not only in Europe. Shale gas will be really very, very important in China. But the fact that the most important possibility of finding shale gas at this point in time is the Ukraine-Poland line is very important. Let me say first for Poland. Poland, for the first time, may be an autonomous energy country. The data that I have, as you know, shale gas is very difficult to measure. It's not you drill once. I mean, you have to drill in many, many places, and to know exactly what is the quantity that you have is not that easy to know. I mean, you can extrapolate. What tells you that Ukraine, and in particular Poland, will have a lot is because they have a lot of coal. And it's something that comes very united. When you have coal, you have shale gas pretty close. That is a tendency that you see it in China, you see it. So in Ukraine, in particular, Poland has. For Poland, it's a fantastic gift. For the first time, it's going to be an autonomous energy country. And they always had the problem of the dependence from Russia, the lack of trust with Germany, so for them it's a blessing. How much influence is going to have? As far as Europe, many, much, very important. As far as Ukraine, the only thing I can tell you that Ukraine is a transit country, and it may become a producer. And it has developed pretty much with companies in Texas already. They are pretty much developing that. But I think that the most important thing in Ukraine is the political class. They have not been able to create political parties. To change leaders from party to party is a common thing. Really, the political structure is not is not functioning. They may have gas, but they have gas already. They didn't handle it properly, and they don't. I'm very, very, very frustrated with the quality of the political leadership in Ukraine. No matter that they have shale gas or if we don't have shale gas, I am much more. I mean, I'm really confident that Poland is going to get to do a very good use of that natural resource that is coming into this country.
This gentleman here and then this gentleman over here. And Rich will come to you.
Good morning. My name is Arnau Gallard from Barcelona, and I'm at the IFC, but I'm an old Georgian student. I want to ask you, we've been talking about the eastern borders, and I'm going to create a hypothetical scenario of the western borders. Let's imagine 2014, there's a referendum for Scotland that says independence, and obviously that moves into maybe other countries like Belgium splitting into Flanders, Wallonia, maybe the Catalan case, etc. If that happens, what would be the legality of these new countries? Would they be European members or not? And what do you think of what has been said, for example, in Spain, like la delegada general del gobierno de Cataluña, saying that Spain would not accept any of these new countries, especially Catalonia being part? How would that affect European security if you have like four or five new states? Obviously, all hypothetical, but how would that affect the future of the EU?
Well, again, this is a question which have no answer because it's potentialities. 2 years for Scotland. We don't know what is going to happen. I don't think we should be talking and taking position of what may happen if. I don't like to do that because I think it doesn't produce any good. So let's keep on working and you do whatever you are working in Catalonia or in Scotland and let's see what happens. My tendency is to think that it will not be very easy to have a European Union of 17 countries already, or 27 countries, to accept a process of fragmentation. When you want to construct something that is super, well, to begin to break it underneath, I think it's a rather contradictory thing. But I respect completely the position of referendums in different countries.
Well, my colleague is taking the microphone over here to this gentleman. I'm just going to make an observation that this very interesting question and careful answer call to mind, and that is in this period when the European Union has both broadened and deepened, there's also been, of course, not just the integration of Europe, but the disintegration of states. I mean, the question of Kosovo came up earlier. Once upon a time, some of us even remember there was a country called Yugoslavia. Does that ring a bell anywhere? How about Czechoslovakia, all one word, no hyphens even. And wasn't there this thing, what was it called? Soviet Union. And we're talking here about independent countries, some more factually independent than others, that have aspirations to be part of an integrated Europe. And I must say, and there are Fiona and others in the room could probably speculate either more, certainly more intelligently and maybe more ominously about the prospect of existing members or, let's say, founding members of the European community breaking up. And then this exactly the dilemma that you pose could arise.
We've been talking a lot about that, in particular one founding member. But it never happens. At the end, never happens. Brussels or Belgium continues to be united. We feared 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that after almost a year without government, without central government, but they recuperated and they keep on. So I think that you may have looser structures within the countries. We have the regions. The European Union is well constructed because it has a place where the regions of the different regions from not one country, from different countries get together. So it's very versatile on doing these type of things already. So I really we can use much better what we have, the institution that we have, without going through that breaking of countries, which I would not recommend. But I mean, I don't recommend as a European.
Yes.
Thank you. My name is Alexander Wolf. I'm a visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins University, and I have a Far Eastern neighborhood question. And you said earlier that the world of today needs structures and institutions for improved global governance, and that the EU engages in building these structures and acts as a model for that. And my question would be, how does the rise of China and other emerging powers influence that task, given that they reject European notions of shared sovereignty and provide an alternative model for global governance amidst the Euro crisis and stuff like that? So I would like to hear you.
Well, I thank you for the question. I think it's very pertinent. I don't think that every country in the world has to be united with others in what we may call molecules. Now, but you have in Asia a very good example that is, in a way, a reflection of the European Union. And I say in a way, because ASEAN was started to move at a very slow pace, and they spent the leaders of ASEAN, they established a commission that went to work with me in Brussels. And after this this learning of how the European Union was working, they produced a document, and that document, with any doubt, has moved the integration of ASEAN today to a much deeper form that you never expected. Now they are now as we were in the monetary system before entering into the zone, the Eurozone, in the monetary system. You remember the monetary system, which were when the UK had that problem with Soros. You remember. So I see the potentiality of other regions of the world, group of countries getting together, sharing sovereignty without losing the identity of the countries and making the global governance way much easier than we have it today. So allow me to play with this metaphor from my previous incarnation. I am a professor of theoretical physics. But imagine that you have oxygen here and hydrogen here. Suppose that, two gases. And you take one electron from here, and instead of rotating around this, you're allowed to rotate by the two. And suddenly, with a little change, recognizing this is hydrogen, Italy, and recognizing this is hydrogen, the Netherlands, by sharing this external electron, they become a gas, which is water, which solves the problem of our life. So small changes, without losing your identity, may produce enormous changes. And that we see in the natural world. And I think that can be seen in the real world. I mean, Westphalia is no longer valid in a world in which we are so much interdependent. Interdependence in Westphalia, I think, have some friction. I don't mean that every country has to do that. In nature, you have very big atoms which are autonomous, let's put it that way. They don't share with anybody. And you can think of countries which are big enough that they don't need any sharing with anybody. But if we were to look into that in Latin America, look at Europe. Europe is a country that gets united with different languages, which is a pretty difficult thing, a common history. Latin America is common history, in a way, common language, and they have some difficulties to get together. They have tried, and they will continue to try, and they will do it. And I'm sure they will do it. They would not one, but maybe three. So you will have that in the Gulf countries. If you see how the Gulf Cooperation Council is moving economically, it's very spectacular what is going on and moving towards a common currency, very much. So we are seeing this movement, which is, let's say, a regionalized world, in which I think it will be much easier to find structures of global governance. And we need a structure of global governance. I believe in that. I believe in that. We cannot we cannot continue living without any structures of governance which are more efficient than the ones we have today. We have climate change, for instance, and many, many, so many things that cannot be governed in Westphalia type of structures, which we have to be more imaginative. And I think that is why the European Union, apart from what I said, has an enormous value today as a model if it functions. And I hope it will, I mean, has functioned. The crisis has come, has a big disturbance, but I think we will be enough to the crisis. We have been very productive, useful, etc., in good weather. Remember that from the year 2001 to the year 2009, the spread of a 10-year bond of Germany, I mean, of spread its relation to Germany, of Italy with Germany was zero, Spain with Germany was zero, Portugal with Germany was zero. We have really a moment in which we have created the euro bonds without any difficulty. Now, so it could be back, this situation. So I think that is a good model still to maintain in our radar screen, even to those who want, as I do, and Strom does, and this institution does want, to work for having a world with governance which is more sophisticated than the one we have today.
While the microphone moves over to Ambassador Kozlerich, I'm just going to recall listening to Professor Solana, Professor of Physics Solana, compare nations to atoms, how he once also commented on either the coincidence or the significance that the number of atoms is approximately, that is to say, the number of atoms on the periodic table is approximately the same as the number of states in the United Nations.
A little bit more states.
Rich Kozlerich, a non-resident fellow here with Fiona Hill and also at Brookings, are at George Mason University. Want to take you to another institution. You were very eloquent about the future of the EU. Can we go to NATO and have you think a little bit about where NATO is heading, setting aside missile defense for a moment? Chicago is going to be about Afghanistan as well and the impact that that experience has had on the alliance as well as its members. And factored into that, of course, are the financial problems that all the member countries of NATO face on the defense side going forward. What do you see as the future of the alliance, and particularly the nature of the U.S.-European relationship within that context, not only given the experience in Afghanistan, but also the experience in Libya?
Well, I don't know, as I said, what is going to happen in Chicago. But looking for the experience of this last times, I think NATO has a role to play, has played. You may like it more or less, but has played a role, which is true what you have said. But that is true also for the United States. The United States has to cut the military budget, the defense budget. If we follow what Secretary Panetta says, and he said it very clearly in the meeting in Munich in February, that it will be a cut serious, and there will be priorities, and the priority will be, military point of view, more towards the East Pacific than other places, Middle East maybe. But it will have to prioritize. So we will have to get an agreement with the United States. How do we handle the NATO expenditures? Because it is true, as you have said, that in a period of crisis, it's more difficult to look about increasing budgets of defense unless you see something very dramatic coming, and it doesn't seem to be the case. No? So we'll have to look into that with a lot of care. I don't think that without an engagement of the United States, NATO can survive very long. I think that it's needed, that leadership in an alliance. It's necessary to have a country like the United States leading. That is my experience. So if the United States doesn't lead in the alliance, it will decline, to my mind.
We're going to take one last question. Take this lady right here.
Sunjin Choi, Langham Partners. Could I follow on your remark on EU energy policies? When I look at EU 27, 36% energy, natural gas import from Russia, one third from crude oil, one third from coal from import from Russia. My question is, in light of what happened to Japan last year, Germany has changed its energy mix. So do you see any other countries will change energy mix? Second question in EU. Second question is, when I look at the EU, as EU implement its sanction in Iran, those countries who suffered most from sovereign debt issues, i.e. in Italy, will have impact on its energy policy. Do you see any EU commissions addressing these issues? Thank you.
Well, you touch on a very, very complicated issue that will take... We will see changing very much in the coming period of time. Shale gas. I mean, we enter into a century where gas is going to be way much more important. But gas, not necessarily through pipelines. The division between consumers and producers is going to change dramatically. China will be a consumer and a producer if he puts into operation the amount of shale gas that they may have. Poland will be a consumer and a producer. So LNG, you have liquefied gas, it becomes the value of consumer and producer changes very much. I think we are going to see a lot of things. And the countries that have the pipelines and the gas will have to adapt also to the new realities, because the situation will be very, very different. The most important reserve for shale gas of today are in China. So imagine the change which is going to take place in the world if this becomes operational. Yesterday was here the Director General of the IMF. He spoke from here, from this place. And he said something, asked about the price of energy. It's just something very interesting that I took good note of it, because it's the first thing that we're going to see. How Japan substitutes the nuclear energy. And that will tell us a lot of how it's going to be, in short term at least, evolution of energy prices, etc. And how rapid is going to be the fracking. The fracking is the breaking of the shale gas. How rapid this is going to take place. There are different legislations. We still don't know how the fracking is going to accept the climate change, the environmental issues. So it's still big questions and big question marks. But I think in the world of energy, we're going to be fascinating changes, also for the European Union.
Well, you certainly managed to elaborate and give us all a chance to share in your... What did you call it? Was it realistic optimism or optimistic realism? Either way.
It's commutative. The order is not important.
Either way. And before thanking Javier, I want to thank all of you for first being here and also participating in such a terrific way. It was a great discussion. And please join me in thanking Javier for coming back to Brooklyn.
Thank you very much. Gracias. Well.